Hello and welcome to Differential Discussions. I'm Melissa.
And I'm Dave.
And today we're back to talk about theory. Feel like we haven't
Everyone
done
loves
this in a
theory.
little while.
It's definitely been a while.
So the
Man,
last
it's been.
thing for theory that we had shared was just the review of primary hemostasis.
Sure. So function of our platelets. So we're trying to find as logical a line through all of this as possible. There's more than one way to kind of ingest the information, but we think that this way makes the most sense. In reality, all these things make the most sense when they're taken in totality. So if something from this lecture is confusing or you reference something about platelets, maybe go visit one of our earlier videos. We even did a video regarding the vasculature, which I think is a In truth, I try to be flexible, but how do you not teach vasculature before the rest of go
Yeah, you have to teach vasculature before. The hard part about the vasculature is that we can't test it. And we don't really have a role in evaluating it because it's not like we can just pull out the patient's vasculature. So
That sounds awful.
it does sound awful.
Oh, shoot.
So
Okay.
today we're going to continue with secondary hemostasis.
And so this is, I think for most folks, this was the bane of their existence in heme class. And for those of you watching us, it might currently be the bane of your existence.
My favorite
So.
is one of my former students. He sent me a meme and it was like learning the coag cascade, forgetting the coag cascade.
It really is. I could say this firsthand too. I mean, so I think certain topics make it more apparent, but in general, knowing things is you have a tenuous grasp on things. And if you don't use it and flex those muscles, those brain muscles, you will lose it for sure. And it's easy to lose a piece of the coag thing, and then yeah, it's all gone.
Yeah, so this talk might be long. It might go over a few episodes just because of the nature of secondary hemostasis and how much we have to cover. But one of the best ways, once you get the material to learn secondary hemostasis, is really to draw the coag cascade over and over again. So, unfortunately, those of you listening, if you're a student and you're learning, you're probably going to have to write this at least a couple of times so that you get familiar with it.
We have a couple little fun cheats
We
that will make
do.
some things easier, but
Yes.
learn by doing over and over and over.
Yes. So I guess let's start with what is secondary hemostasis?
So with primary hemostasis, we've established our platelet plug, right, as it's called. But platelets are imperfect, right? There's going to be spaces between platelets, and I kind of view the formation of fibrin as that, like, so if platelets are like bricks, the secondary hemostasis fibrin product is sort of the cement between the bricks, right? That really stabilizes the clot.
So we're working with proteins this go around.
And they're really neat. So most of these proteins we'll find are soluble and become insoluble. And so there are certain ways of talking about coag and the therapeutics associated with a coag that will make my skin crawl, and I imagine Melissa's skin crawl, like things like blood thinners. I really hate it because it's just so inaccurate.
Boo. Boo.
Yeah,
I
boo.
teach in a PA program, and one of the first things I tell them is there's no such thing as blood thinners. Don't call them blood thinners.
Yeah, and I think some people may think we're being like a little bit pedantic, but in truth, it really is just is such a crazy misnomer that I just don't like using it.
Agreed.
So where do we start? Maybe identifying the factors, I guess. So One of the ways that we do that in the classroom is just running through the numbers. So they all have names associated with them and numbers.
Yes. So numbers, it's important to note that most clotters or coagulation folk, as we call ourselves clotters, we still refer to coag factors by their Roman numerals. So you're going to see the Roman numerals and not the Arabic numbers.
And it is a bummer when you get the anywho, but yeah,
Yes.
it's just
You could
it's
just,
better that way.
it's just, you know, it's I, V, V. Those terrible. So you just got to get familiar with Roman numerals. And it's important that everyone does because that's the way that the numbers are referred to. So when we talk about coag factors, there's, oops, I, oops, I'm drawing on the wrong things. I,
And it is mechanistically makes the process better.
yeah. I guess the other thing that's important to know is that factors 1 through 4 are really referred to by their names and not by their numbers.
Yes, and this is the part that can get a little confusing too. That I was just thinking about is, it stinks when the name is used invoked in, instead of the number in certain situations, and you're forced to recall. So we'll probably write some of the names that are associated with, but like, yeah, we
Oops, I
never
s
say factor one, right? We never say factor one, but then alternatively, we never say the Christmas factor, right? So like, we have a little bit of inconsistency here. That's kind of a bummer, but we'll work through it.
Yeah, so these are your coag factors. These guys right here. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. If you've, you know, learned anything about coag, you're like, wait, factor six? There's no such thing as factor six. There was a factor six when and when you they found they discovered factor five, and then they discovered what they called factor six, and then realized it was just factor five activated. And so they, you know, kind of scratched that out. And so we have 1 through 5 and then 7 through 13.
It's another kind of useful thing to think about too. So many of these factors have their inactive form and then an activated form. So if you see the new Roman numeral written as such here, that's the inactive. And then we usually use a small a to denote the activated form. So for example, I might reference 2 or 2A. So 2A implies that there's been a chemical change, and so they behave differently.
Yeah,
And that
so I
might
guess
be
that's
useful.
a great way to start because when they are inactive, they are called, I can't write apparently, but they're called zymogens when they're inactive. Zymogen.
Yeah, so
And
this
that.
implies that they have some kind of an enzymatic effect, but not in their current state, right? Something has to happen to change them.
Correct. Yeah, so zymogen is just a fancy term for an inactive protein. That's it. It's not going to do anything. You have to cleave it to activate it in order to get it to do something. So that's what zymogen is. And you'll hear zymogen whenever you know, whenever you're talking about coagulation, you'll hear it. Sometimes in clinical chemistry, you hear zymogen too, because basically any protein that needs to be activated before it's activated is the zymogen form. Okay, so
All
these are
right.
our factors. One, and I think we'll talk a little bit more about the factors as we go.
Anything else we should establish before we start?
No, I think we can talk about the models.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Well, actually, before we go into the models, we should probably talk about vitamin K deficiency or
Sure.
vitamin K dependent factors before we get to
Sure.
deficiency.
And this is where it really does get super complicated. Because you have procoagulants and anticoagulants that are vitamin K dependent.
Well, let's just talk about, okay, so I guess let's see, you guys get to hear us live. We don't script this stuff. We're just like, yeah, let's go for it. Let's get rid of vitamins. So let's talk about the different types of coag factors. So there's zymogens, right? And those are the ones that are actually All of our
Like most
Kawaii
of them.
characters. All except for three and four. No? Yeah, three and four will have will not have inactive and active forms. But one, two, 7 through 13 will have inactive and active forms, but some of them are serine proteases. That's an E. Some of them are cofactors. I can't write today. So, for example, 5 and 8 are cofactors. And then our serine proteases are going to be factors. I can write sometimes. Basically,
Pretty much everything
everything.
else, yeah.
13. Well, actually, that's not true. 13 is not a serine
Yeah.
protease. That's a transglutaminase, but that's a different story. So 12, 11, 10, 9, not 8, 7, not
And
4,
so
not 3, but
as the
2.
term protease might imply to you, right? So as you learn all this bio stuff, we kind of make associations. When you have that ACE at the end, it kind of means some kind of an enzymatic effect. So, and so this is going to make a change to a particular chemical class, and they happen to be proteins. So it's that's kind of how I remember it. And we'll see that they kind of in some kind of way, is a sequentially cascade into like a final end product.
And we'll talk about the so I guess that's a good segue into the models. So when you think about secondary hemostasis, also known as coagulation, there's two major models. There is the coag cascade model, which is the easiest one, easiest one to learn. It's the one that works best when we're thinking about laboratory testing. And then there's the cell-based model, which is really what's happening physiologically in vivo when coagulation is activated. So we'll touch on both. We'll focus mostly on the coag cascade model because for student purposes, that's probably the most important.
And even if as if I want my laboratorians working next to me to know one of them, it's the coag cascade model, just because it helps with testing and yeah. All right. So we start with the names, I guess, or
Well, I guess let's start with, yeah, the different. So in the cascade model, there's three major portions to the pathway because it's a big
yeah,
giant
okay.
pathway. So let's start with the easiest. We'll do the extrinsic pathway. So the extrinsic pathway is really quite easy. That's why we're starting with it. You have
Yeah,
the
it's like
release.
one terminal.
You have the release of tissue factor. So, tissue factor is a substance that is not typically found within the vasculature. It's found sub with your subendothelial collagen. So, underneath the endothelial cells that you have lining the vasculature, underneath that first layer, the fibroblasts are really what's going to secrete tissue factor underneath there. And so we get tissue factor released when you damage the vasculature.
And so this is quite genius, right? So like coagulation is a critically important part of homeostasis as a whole, right? Of maintaining an organism's life. But we don't want it just happening all the time. And so this is sort of a genius, I'll describe intelligence here, but like evolutionarily very advantageous to have something that's not around all the time. And so yeah, tissue factors that juice in the in the tissue. This is going super well, isn't it, Lindsay? And now tissue factor combines with which factor to form our extrinsic tenase?
Yes, so
So
it's going to be
factor
factor
seven.
seven activated. So tissue factor can activate factor seven if it doesn't have any factor seven activated around. So it can do that. So I guess we'll draw
And
that.
as I understand, we do have low levels of seven activated circulating, right?
We do, which sounds like you would think about that and be like, that doesn't sound good to have activated factor seven, but activated factor seven isn't going to do anything unless it's got its partner in crime, which is
So a
mission
little bit of
factor.
a, yeah, a little bit of a check there.
So they're partnered together, and this is literally what leads you to activating the common pathway, but it needs some help. So we're going to form, I think, Dave, you said it earlier, the extrinsic 10As complex. So let me just write 10As. So As is an enzyme, and it's telling you what substrate it's going to act on.
I love the group of scientists that did all this. There was no like, I want my name in here or anything like that. They're like, nah, this makes sense.
Yes. So our extrinsic 10As complex is two factor, activated factor seven, phospholipid, and calcium. So wait, let's back up for a second. Where did the phospholipid come from?
And this is such an important piece, okay? So clotting, in vivo clotting, never exists if not for the presence of platelets, generally, right? So platelets, in physiological settings, present the phospholipid necessary for these 10ase complex to form in your cuvette. And if you look at your reagents, a lot of your reagents for coag are going to include phospholipid. Because in general, we have a specimen that we've spun down and we're just using the plasma. So there is no platelet in that for testing. So, yeah.
Yeah,
And the
so
calcium kind of comes from the platelets too. I mean,
yes.
it's genius.
Yes. So we release calcium from within the platelets, especially those dense granules. We release them, extracellularly. And then the phospholipid is coming from the activated surface of the platelet. Because remember, we go through that phospholipid flip where we expose the polar phospholipids when we activate the platelets. So we have our phospholipid, where's my mouse? There it is. We have the phospholipid coming from the platelet membrane, and then we have the calcium coming from within the dense granules of our platelets. So this lends itself to that cell-based model, right? We're dipping our pinky fingers into it a little bit because we're sharing that, but we're not the cell-based model is pretty different, but we'll get there eventually. Again, this is the cascade-based model. And then, like we said, this is the extrinsic 10As complex. So it's going to activate factor 10. Okay. And remember, X is Roman numeral 10, and we're changing it to 10A. So we're 10 activated here. So that's what the little A again is telling us, the activated form. Okay. So now we have completed the extrinsic pathway.
I love it.
So we hit the common pathway now. And it's common because it's common between both the extrinsic and the intrinsic pathway. So I guess we can do the intrinsic pathway.
Sure, that'd probably be best, yeah.
Okay. So now our intrinsic pathway, right?
This is a little weird.
So the intrinsic pathway starts with what we call our contact factors. And this includes high molecular weight kininogen. Everyone's like, what?
We trust us. Me too.
So we have high molecular.
Precalicrin.
Yeah. Back over there, prekallikrein, and then factor 12. So with these guys, essentially, they will play, well, I guess we'll talk a little bit more about the role that they play once we get there, but just kind of going through it, factor 12 is going to be activated autocatalytically. So it activates when it comes into contact with really highly negatively charged surfaces. And then it activates prekallikrein. So you get activated factor 12. Oops, I'm putting my pen in the wrong spot. And then it's going to activate prekallikrein into kallikrein. And then high molecular weight kininogen is kind of just like a hanger on. It's bound to prekallikrein and it is activated into some bradykinins. But really, bradykinins and kallikrein have major functionalities in inflammatory processes and shock. So they don't play a huge role over here, other than this whole process is what's going to activate the major factors of the intrinsic pathway. So factor 11. Oh, I did
So
it. I did it wrong.
yeah. So yeah, all right. So yeah, very important that the intrinsic cascade is the reason why we care about most of this is because it enables us to isolate some of these factors in testing a little bit better. Yeah. And we'll get to that. So you get to kind of bear with us for the whole narrative and then put everything together afterwards.
So I know this is confusing, but 11 activates 9. So 11 activated activates 9 to 9 activated.
And we have a fun thing for this. So just bear with us here while we just vomit out the order.
And then this takes us over to the common pathway. But again, like we have the extrinsic 10As complex, we have the intrinsic 10As complex. So we
Which is
have
incredibly important.
activated factor 9 with activated factor 8. And again, we have phospholipid and calcium. So a couple of things. One, the phospholipid and calcium come from the same place as the extrinsic 10As complex, so the platelet. The other thing is, you do not need both the intrinsic and the extrinsic 10As complexes to activate factor 10. You only need one. So in this case, we're talking about the intrinsic one. So that has activated factor 9, activated factor 8, phospholipid, and calcium. And then you're probably like, wait, where did 8 come from?
Yeah, me too.
We'll get there. We'll get there. We're not there yet. We'll get
This is why the
there.
both models are going to be important. So we're
Yes.
starting with this coag cascade one, but it'll make more sense later. Promise, sort of.
Sort of. Okay. So that's the intrinsic 10As complex activates factor 10. And then, okay, so now we're at the common pathway. So now let's activate. Let's keep going. What is it? Factor 10
Yeah.
activated. It's going to
So 10 is
activate.
good at activating
Oh,
two.
I
Well,
just wrote. I'm thinking about 5. That's why I'm writing 5, but it's 2 now.
And we'll get to five. Yeah, five is important, very important.
And remember, we said 2 is typically not referred to as factor 2. And that's factor 2, not factor 11. Remember, Roman numerals. So factor 2 is prothrombin, and it's activated into thrombin. But when you're writing on whiteboards and you're trying to scribble really quickly, it's much easier to write 2 and 2A. Okay, so I threw in factor 5 already. So let's meet my friend factor 5.
To five.
So we need another complex.
And this is the last one, but it's
This
a
one
doozy.
is the prothrombinase complex. So if we go with the same thought process.
Let's take a guess what's going to be in there, right?
This is the enzyme that activates that substrate, right? So we're activating prothrombin into thrombin. So again, we need to have factors. So we have activated factor 5, activated factor 10, and you must say activated because factor 5 and 10 will not do anything, but activated factor 5 and activated factor. Okay, and then we have to have our trusty phospholipid and our trusty calcium that's coming from the same place. Okay.
And so the fact that all of these, the 10ACEs and prothrombinase, all need calcium and phospholipid is neat because later on, well, for now, we can kind of think of it really localizes the response of coag, right? So I think when I was first learning about coag and you're thinking about activated factors and they're in circulation, right? So we really want this activity localized at the site of injury. And so this is a really big piece of that.
So let's take one second and just talk about the complexes. So we have the intrinsic tenase, the extrinsic tenase, and the prothrombinase. One of the ways you can think about this is to think about cupcakes. So let me, I think, I don't know how to do it over here. I think I just scroll around. Well, let's just draw it over here. So I'm going to draw cupcakes. I know I'm a terrible drawer. They look like mushrooms, but just pretend they're a cupcake, okay? So this is my cupcake. Now, if you want to have a good cupcake, right, what do you need? You need cake, you need frosting, and you need sprinkles. You need to have all three. Otherwise, your cupcake sucks. So I have all three, cake, frosting, and sprinkles. So we have our cake, right? So what flavor cake do you like, Dave?
So I like them all, but like I'm a chocolate fiend.
All right, so this is our chocolate cake here. And our chocolate cake, let's pretend, is activated factor 8 and activated factor 9. Okay, so whenever we have our chocolate cake, we have to have activated factor 9, activated factor 8. We have to have frosting, which is phospholipid, and we have to have sprinkles, which is calcium, right? So you have to have cake, frosting, and sprinkles every time you have a cupcake. You can have different flavors of cake, right? Maybe I want a vanilla cupcake. I know you're looking at it thinking it's a mushroom, not a cupcake, Melissa, but that's okay. It's now a cupcake, right? And this is going to be my vanilla cupcake, and I'm going to have activated factor 7 and tissue factor. But I still have to have frosting and sprinkles. So I always have to have phospholipid and calcium, but my cake flavor is different. And then maybe we want to have a funfetti cake. I know my cupcakes get worse and worse as we go. Still have to have frosting and sprinkles. Right? And then this flavor would be our 5 activated and our 10 activated. So if you need things to help remember these complexes, if you don't want to just flat out memorize, you want something to help you, think about them as cupcakes. Almost everybody likes cupcakes. Mm-hmm. Almost everybody. Oh, this is terrible. Bear with me while I scribble this out.
It's functional.
I just don't want to erase the whole thing and get rid of the cascade. Okay. All right. So now let's get back to thrombin. So here we have thrombin, and I'm going to draw this nice little cloud thing around thrombin because thrombin is really important. Thrombin is going to come back and activate a lot of different things, do a lot of different things. But one of the major, well, most of the things it does are major, but one of the major, major things that it does is it's going to activate fibrinogen into fibrin.
Yeah, there's like fibrinogen is obviously the most important, but man, right there is prothrombin, thrombin, right? Like critically important.
Mm-hmm. So we have fibrinogen, which was its zymogen form, right? It's not doing anything. Well, it's not really going to do anything, but you're going to activate fibrinogen into fibrin monomers, right? You're cleaving it, you're chopping off a piece. Essentially, I mean, all of your coagulation proteins look like this, right? They look like any other protein. But when you look at the overall structure of fibrinogen, it's got an E domain here in the center and then 2 D domains, one on each side. And then it's kind of got these weird looking antler things, which are its little fibrinopeptides. This is fibrinogen. So when we're cleaving it from fibrinogen into fibrin, literally all we're doing are cleaving off the antlers. Okay. So now this is our fibrin molecule because we want to expose certain binding sites so that other molecules can come along and do their thing and help fibrin monomers, right? This is a fibrin monomer, become a fibrin polymer. It's supposed to be an M. There we go. So we need to make it into a fibrin polymer.
Herein comes 13.
Yeah. So now we have activated factor 13, which I said earlier is a transglutaminase. So factor 13 is literally going to move molecules around to help covalent bonds form in between these fibrin monomers to create, essentially your fibrin monomers are soluble. And then we're going to create insoluble fibrin polymers. And that is how you make a clot.
Mm-hmm. Easy peasy. All right. See you later.
So I guess like when you, let's come back to thrombin. I think I can change the color here. Yeah. Let's make it red. So I'm going to redraw my little cloud here around thrombin. And let's talk about all the things that thrombin does.
Yeah. So if you ever like have a test situation and it's like, what does thrombin activate? The answer is yes.
What doesn't thrombin activate?
Yeah, that's a much shorter list. Yeah. So this is where thrombin's really, really, really cool. And I probably would fail the test right now in telling you exactly what it would activate, but like everything. Yeah, certainly so, some of the most important ones. Remember we talked about 8? Where the heck did 8 come from?
Yeah. Well, the most obvious one we already did was fibrinogen.
Sure. Yeah. Sure.
Yes, but then we have factor 8. So it's going to activate factor 8. The other one that we were like, where did this come from, was factor 5.
Yep.
And another one is 13. I guess another less obvious one.
And those platelets. Are like the sort of the big, so platelets have thrombin receptors.
They do.
I almost kind of forgot that.
Yeah, they have different receptors on them that can activate platelets.
And that's an aggressive receptor too, right, Melissa? Yes,
yeah. It is.
So not everything's created equal.
Yeah. All right, then what else is it going to activate? Again, like Dave said, yes. So it's going to come back and activate a lot of things. So it can help us activate.
It's like 11, right? Yeah,
11.
9.
Not 9. 9. Something else is going to activate 9.
I
don't care. This stupid thing, sorry. Okay, it's gonna help us.
I'll tell you, even the textbook printers have trouble with this stuff.
Oh no, I was having trouble with my pen.
Well, I'm just saying, some of the diagrams get pretty busy, you know?
They do. Yeah. Well, and another thing that it activates that we haven't even talked about yet is protein C.
So, an anticoagulant.
Yeah. So earlier, when we were talking about, just a few minutes ago, we mentioned factor 9. So this right here, the extrinsic 10-ase complex can also activate factor 9. And this comes into play. And this is where the importance of knowing what activates what, knowing what does what, is really important when we're thinking about disease states. Because you, the listener, the student, is probably thinking, when am I ever going to use this? Well, I used to use it all the time when I worked in the special coagulation lab, because there's not really like there are written procedures for you. But, you know, when you think about like what is happening in vitro versus what is happening in vivo. So what are the patient's symptoms? What's going on? What do the lab test results look like? Really helps you help the physician know which lab tests are important. So, you know, they've ordered all of these tests. What else can I order? What other things should they be thinking about? And sometimes they call and ask that. And you say, well, you could order this because of this. You could order that because of that. So, you know, we're the experts in the laboratory testing. They're the experts in the patients. So we can kind of work together. And I used to do that a lot. So kind of knowing this stuff and knowing, well, if tissue factor and activated factor 7 is activating 9, does factor 11 really have a big physiological impact? I guess when we talk about diseases, we'll find out. Okay, so this is really the coag cascade. All of the more procoagulant, we haven't really touched into any of the control features yet, but this is the features of setting up that cascade. So when you think about the different, let me just get these out of the way. When we think about the different pathways, you know, there's the intrinsic pathway. So your intrinsic pathway is going to have factor 11, factor 9, factor 8. And then, of course, you could include 12 and high molecular weight kininogen and prekallikrein. And then your extrinsic pathway is going to have 7. That's about it. And then your common pathway has 1, 2, 5, and 10. Now, 13 is here also, but I'm going to put it here and I'm going to put it in parentheses. The reason for that is most of your clot-based assays will not measure for factor 13 because 13 is your stabilizing factor. It's stabilizing the clot that forms and making it that cement that Dave was talking about with his brick analogy at the beginning. So if you have a clot-based assay like a PT or an APTT, and you run that, you're going to get it measuring up until the point of clot formation. That's it. And then it stops. So we don't actually see the clot stability. So factor 13 is included in the common pathway. Yes. But when you think about laboratory testing, it's not included in the common pathway.
So yeah, traditional laboratory testing, PT-PTT, is not representative of the ability of patients 13 to stabilize a clot. Yeah. So we have other assays that specifically isolate 13 that we can use if we think that that might be an issue. And then clinically, there's a little bit of a different presentation, right? With some folks that have 13 deficiencies. So.
Yep.
So yeah. So the other thing too, I think to maybe right now is to attach, for those of you familiar with the COAG assays, the extrinsic cascade is tested by the PT and the PTT for the intrinsic cascade. And we can kind of see, if you look at reference range values, well, PT interval is significantly shorter than the PTT, but we can kind of see why. There's less kind of business going on there. So I typically kept it straight initially in my head.
Yes. Yes, so your PT, I always remember PTX. PT is the extrinsic, PTX. And it's significantly shorter because it's the extrinsic and the common pathway, which together is really only looking at these five factors. And then when you think about the APTT, the activated partial thromboplastin time, this is looking at all six of these factors plus these four factors. So it's a lot. Not a lot, but it's slower. It's significantly slower when you compare it to the extrinsic and the common. So the PT has a shorter reference interval because you're dealing with shorter number of factors. Excuse me, and the intrinsic or the APTT is dealing with a lot more factors. So it's going to take a lot more time to activate everything.
Cool. Where do we go from here?
Well, I think where we could go next is the control proteins.
Yikes.
So, let me erase these bad boys. And then we'll think about our control proteins. So I guess let's move on to a blue color. Why don't we start with protein C and protein S? Okay, so protein C is another zymogen, and it needs to be cleaved into its active form in order to become active and do its thing. I wonder what activates protein C.
And so this is where this process really does become quite complicated, because for someone like me who likes to follow kind of a mechanistic, logical order. Having a procoagulant like thrombin activate an anticoagulant control protein like protein C is a little confusing. But it makes sense in the end after you study it for like a crazy amount of time. But yeah, for right now, just know that that's how that becomes activated.
Yes. So let's talk about that, right? So let's see if I can. What? Oh, okay, there we go. Scroll.
Does protein S have an activated form?
No, you don't activate protein S. Did the screen scroll for you, Dave?
It did. It did.
Okay, good. All right. So I just want to draw it down here. So we're gonna have protein C as your major protein, and then protein S is its cofactor. And protein S does not need to be activated. It is already in its active form, but it's a cofactor, so it's not really going to do anything all on its own. I guess we'll talk about protein S for a moment. So protein S is either free or it's bound. And when we say free or bound, what is it bound to? It's bound to complement. It binds to one of your complement proteins. Now, what happens? What is complement? Where does that come from? Oh my goodness, that's another one of these weird complexes here, pathways. So complement is really involved in inflammation. So whenever you have inflammatory processes, your amount of complement that you have increases in your body. And whenever you have complement increasing, the amount of bound protein S also increases. So think of it as you only have a finite amount of protein S, and it's either free or bound. And the amount that's bound depends on the amount of complement or the amount of inflammation present in the patient's body. So free protein S, which we'll call FPS, right? Free protein S is active. This is the one that's active in coagulation. Bound is not. So whenever it looks like your protein S is decreased, right? The free protein S is what's important. So if free protein S is decreased, that could either be because protein S is decreased or you have inflammation and more of it is bound. So free protein S is what we need. Active in coagulation. And it's important to say that pregnancy is an inflammatory process. So your protein S is always decreased whenever you're having a patient who's pregnant. Okay, on the flip side, because that's just your cofactor, you need protein C. So protein C needs to be activated. So here we've got the surface of some wonderful endothelial cells, and we've got some receptors here. So we've got one that's called thrombomodulin. And then you've got one next door that's called endothelial protein C receptor.
Love the name.
I wonder what binds to endothelial protein C receptor. It's protein C. And then what binds? Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I was just going to say, we see some of these things in nature where the role of them is to bring two different molecules close together to like do a thing with each other, right? So,
yes.
Sorry, continue.
No, that's great. That's perfect, because you could always think of these two receptors as matchmakers, online dating, whatever you want to think of it as. It's essentially pairing protein C with its activating molecule, which we know is thrombin. And the reason why this is helpful is because if you think about, let's use dating as an analogy. If you're dating and you're walking around the park and you're living your life, what's the chances that you're going to bump into somebody that you want to date?
And that they may be receptive
yes.
to your advances too. I mean, that's an important part. So it might be difficult to approach someone just randomly out in the environment.
You're in the
have
park
a
and you're
successful
like,
encounter.
Yes, that's it. Hello, I'm here to activate you. So it could happen. Right.
Yeah,
but the chances of it happening are significantly decreased. Now, if you're using a matchmaking service of some kind, so we'll use online dating, right? You get to kind of sift through and bring the matches to a mutually agreed upon location where then you can have your date. So this is similar, where we know where thrombomodulin and endothelial protein C receptor are. They're going to be right there, and you're going to have the two molecules bind, and you're going to be able to activate a lot more protein C than you would just kind of free floating around. So that's the whole point of these guys, is to activate protein C. So then you have your activated protein C and your free protein S complex. Because remember, free protein S is just the cofactor. And now let's, oh, I gotta, that's right, I gotta do this. Okay. Let's scroll back up to our coag cascade. And what are these guys gonna do? Well, they're gonna go and take out our major cofactors. So they're gonna, oops, I need to put my pen back. There we go. They're going to inactivate activated factor 5, and they're going to inactivate activated factor 8. Yep. So why is that a big deal?
Yeah, so that turns off the floodgates, so to speak. So one of the things that I think is really interesting to talk about, and it doesn't need to be memorized, but it's nice when it's understood, that even though some of these factors, you know, like what 9 activates 10, right? It does, but it activates very little. It's very slow. It's kind of a lazy reaction. Whereas the 10 aces, the 7 ace, the extrinsic 10 ace, 7 ace, I'm just making stuff up. The extrinsic 10 ace, a bit slower. But like, think of all of those phospholipid calcium blocks as activating thousands of fold faster, right? Crazy, crazy fast. So that increase in speed and reactivity kind of changes the game, right? So to get to a full clot, you've got to activate a ton of 1-2, you know, fibrinogen to fibrin. It's going to take a lot of reactivity. So if we can turn off those explosive big reactors, so to speak, that are our cupcakes, we can stop coag. Like, we could say, all right, we're done, right? We're done here. We're not going to consume all those individual factors. And the tissue, the extrinsic 10-ase, kind of is self-limiting in the fact that once a wound has been appropriately kind of covered, tissue factor kind of gets shut off, right? I mean, so like, and then we have tissue factor pathway inhibitor. So we have other things as well, but yeah. So, protein C and in its brother, sister, protein S, it's a very, very important system to turn off all this. And we'll see pathologically when there's issues with protein C that we can get a really hypercoagulant state that's dangerous.
Yeah, and let me just add to that with, like, for example, factor 8. When you think about factor 9 activated, it wants to activate 10, but it's a really, I don't want to say finicky, I don't want to say unstable, because it's not unstable, but it's a very wobbly molecule. So factor 9 activated really needs to interact with the phospholipid of the platelet, and it needs to interact and become stable in order for it to really be able to bind onto 10 and activate. So what 8 does, literally what factor 8 does for factor 9 activated, factor 8 activated, is it stabilizes factor 9. So rather than having this wobbly site that wants to grab onto 10 to activate it, it stabilizes that molecule so it can easily grab onto 10 and activate it. And the other thing that it does is it helps to bridge that connection with the phospholipid of the platelet. So that's literally what factor 8 activated does for factor 9 activated. So factor 8 activated is not doing any activating itself. It's just stabilizing 9 activated so that it can do its job way more efficiently than what it does on its own. So when we think about these cofactors, when we remove them, the process is going to significantly slow down and give us time to get other controlled proteins in to help shut things off. And so with protein C and protein S, we get rid of the intrinsic 10-ase complex, and the prothrombinase complex. The extrinsic kinase complex, like Dave said, we kind of ignore it because it's shut off so rapidly. It's one of the first things that gets shut off because tissue factor pathway inhibitor, TFPI, comes along and inhibits tissue factor 7 activated when they're complexed together, or they can also be bound to factor 10. So either way, it's going to shut off the complex and not allow them to keep going with the process. And of course, like Dave said, you only have so much tissue factor coming out. And once you limit it and get rid of that exposure, then you stop with the extrinsic pathway. Okay. So let's, I guess, hit the other major. Maybe we'll go with purple so we're consistent with our warm, our cool colors here. And we'll talk about antithrombin. Antithrombin. So it's already telling you one of the proteins that it's going to inhibit. Thrombin, which is really important.
Yeah. Yeah. So we can see the fact that thrombin is so... Thrombin's like the, you know, I think of these as like when thrombin's there, it turns into like a blaze. Like you have like a small little campfire, and this is like a roaring, like bonfire, and getting two to calm down is really important. Yeah,
it's like lighter fuel.
Yes, antithrombin.
So antithrombin is a serpin or serine protease inhibitor. So it's going to go inhibit all of our serine proteases. So that's 2, 9, 10, 11, 12, all activated. So 2 activated, 9 activated, 10 activated, 11 activated, and 12 activated. And I always think about it that way, 2, 9, 10, 11, 12. That's just the easy way to remember what it inactivates. So you can see with antithrombin, you've basically shut off the common pathway and the intrinsic pathway. With TFPI, you shut off the extrinsic pathway. And with protein C, protein S, you shut off your complexes here, these two major complexes.
Yeah.
And so now you just have stable clot.
Yeah, we never want to infinite clot. That's not, we don't want that. You know, a lot of times when people have blood clotting disorders or a physiological state that lends itself to thrombi, pathological clot formation, it's usually because there is something pushing them into a procoagulant state, and then perhaps one or more of these systems are unable to function effectively. And then that produces really, really quite dangerous. I forget the statistics, but the number of people that die every year because of a blood clot is very high. This is a huge mortality, morbidity issue.
Well, and so many things can induce thrombosis because when you think about any slight imbalance with these or platelets, or fibrinolysis, which we haven't even touched on yet, can really tip you to becoming more prone to clot formation. The other thing is when you think about like factor 12 and prekallikrein and high molecular kininogen and all of them being really active, factor 12 can be activated during times of inflammation or by bacterial surfaces. And so those things can also lead to the formation of clots when you are overactively activating coagulation or I guess inappropriately activating coagulation.
Yeah, so we'll see that inflammation broadly puts you in a hypercoagulable state. And in a lot of different ways, because we talked about protein S, right? So inflammation goes up. We haven't mentioned it yet, but like fibrinogen. Fibrinogen is an acute phase reactant, positive acute phase reactant. So in inflammatory conditions, you have a combination of things. It's more complicated than this, but things like fibrinogen goes up and then protein S goes down, right? Free protein S goes down. You start to stack a lot of these things on top of each other with other risk factors, and that's where we end up getting these thrombi and different situations. So things like sepsis, things known to cause DIC, just, you know, DIC, very complicated process of clotting and bleeding. And these all upset a balance. So the more I learned and the more my understanding grew, it became clearer to me that a lot of these systems aren't necessarily off and on. They're not like binary light switches. It's more like those dimmer switches. It's a bunch of different dimmer switches that are all kind of pushing and pulling on each other.
Mm-hmm.
It's beautiful and fascinating and also infuriating and life deranging when you have to know it really well.
Yeah, absolutely. And then also cancer tips the just the homeostasis when you're thinking about coagulation, because thrombosis associated cancer is something that's really dangerous. There's also, when you think about like some of your hemolytic anemias causing inflammation, also activating coagulation. This is a whole coag, like I always say, coag runs the world. It's really important just because it can play a role in everything.
Yeah, it's, and it's probably the last big piece of hematology that was taught to me. And I think that's for a really good reason. Like, I think you can kind of get introduced to coag, but really getting the whole material makes you understand a lot of other pathophys much, much better.
Well, and coag's kind of that bridge between hematology and chemistry.
100%. Yeah, I agree.
Because it's basically clinical chemistry, because it's a complex biochemical pathway.
Absolutely.
But it more lives in hematology, but also it plays a role in blood banking. So
yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Blood banking has a role in giving products to sort of stabilize the system in one way or the other, pro or anticoagulant. So,
yeah.
It is far reaching. And then you have our microbiologists whom the infections are causing, perhaps clotting issues and things like that.
It could be the actual organism causing the issue.
Yeah.
Or it could be the inflammation because of the organism causing the issue.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it's all connected. All us MLS really people. Yeah. You know?
Well, I think this is a good place to end for this presentation, with just kind of going over general secondary hemostasis, the coag cascade based model, introducing the intrinsic, extrinsic, common pathways, thrombin's major functionalities, and then the major regulatory proteins that are also associated with it. And we'll continue on, and we'll talk about, of course, the actual cell-based model, and then we'll also talk about fibrinolysis and continue on from there. Not in this episode, obviously. So I think that's
take
all
a break.
Yeah. Right. Relax.
Thanks for sticking it out with us.
Yeah, everybody. So thanks for listening.
Yeah, thanks for your time.